And I've now asked Shannon to share.
Hello, everybody. So first of all, I just want to say thank you for asking me to speak at Serenity Night. I just want to share that so 2 years ago on December 19th was Serenity Night, and that was the last day I threw up. Oh, wow, that's a little emotional. That was also the first day I called my sponsor on the same day I threw up. And that was the day that I came here anyway. And that's when the story of my recovery has been showing up anyway, despite how incredibly imperfect everything I do is. In fact, the more imperfectly I do it, the better I do it, which is, into my crazy head, a total oxymoron and not acceptable. But it's true. If I'm willing to show up, regardless of how badly I do it, I get rewards, personal spiritual rewards, beyond anything I could ever imagine. What it was like. And then I don't know what happened. I didn't binge and purge after that day. Although it has been very imperfect 2 years. I've not had a whole host of binge foods. I don't eat recreational sugar, however, which is like cakes, cookies, candies. But as the 2 years have progressed, basically, sugar in all its forms is just not okay with me. and I'm just learning that that's how that works. The window narrows. And also I don't throw up no matter what. And then I've had to put up with a lot of life in between that stuff and a lot of imperfect abstinence. But if I had to do abstinence perfectly, I wouldn't keep coming back, because I can't. I'm so human and I'm so fallible. That's one of the beautiful things of this program, is that I used to not understand how okay that was, and now it's the only way I can get up in the morning. So I have a picture, which I forgot to bring up with me. I was going to pass around. So thank you. And all I want to say about her, which is me, about 7 years ago, is that she was living in a little apartment on Beacon Hill, and she spent all of her free time binging and purging. And the apartment was basically, if you've ever seen that show Hoarders, that's how I was living. I did not clean up after my eating disorder, nor did I clean up after all of the cigarettes or the alcohol or anything. And there was, I had gotten to the point, I think for a year, I couldn't even go into my bedroom. There was rotting food everywhere. It was just so painful and ugly. And one time I was having some people come over, and it took me 4 days to clean. And this was like a 600 square foot apartment. And I was all the time I couldn't wait to leave work to get to the grocery store to go buy these massive amounts of food. And then I would just lay as if on drugs, and I would binge until I could barely stand up and barely make it to the bathroom. And it was such a violent, ugly way to hate myself in every way that I possibly could. I did not want to be in my body. I did not want to be myself. And food was the best way I had, and it was the only way I had. The way I see it is that I have two choices. I have food, or I have a spiritual solution, because I don't have any other choice but food anymore, except this. That's it. It's the only thing in my whole life that ever gave me actual freedom from living like that. And that was a pure prison. And so I debated it in my head. I don't like to talk about what that was like. It's very difficult, because there's a tremendous amount of shame and fear around being somebody that lived like that. I remember the first time I saw that show, Hoarders. Maybe it wasn't the first time. It was one of the times I saw it, and they showed a bulimic who is living that way. And I was just very struck, because I you know, you always think you're the only one. Like, we're so terminally unique, except for we're not. You know, somebody else there, out there has done what I've done, you know. I know this is kind of weird, but sometimes I judge bulimics whether they were the same, better, or worse than me as a bulimic. Whatever. Really, I wouldn't wish that on anybody. So, okay, that's what it was like, and I'm just going to move on from that. So what happened? So I was, a lot of you have heard this story, but it's kind of cool. I was in Hawaii. I was at a wedding. I had been up all night the night before eating the chocolate-covered whatever things that you have lots of in Hawaii, and I had been to a wedding, and I had binged my way through the wedding, and my sister was with me, and I was all over crazy because I had a resentment against the bride. I didn't understand about resentments back then. I just thought people really screwed up all the time. And so she had done many horrible things, which now when I think about it, I'm like, doesn't seem that bad to me anymore. It's kind of strange. But anyway, my sister and I were cleaning up our hotel room and getting ready to leave on the flight home. And she looked under the bed, and she's like, oh, there's a book under here. And she pulled it out, and we thought it was a Bible. And then it was this book right here. And she looked at the spine, and she said, Overeaters Anonymous. And when she said that, it was like somebody came and plucked a string in my chest. I had never heard of it before. I had been, like, I was so isolated in that apartment living. I mean, there was times nobody came in for over a year. I mean, it was crazy. But I knew when I heard those words that that was for me. So, you know, on the plane ride home, I'm binging and purging in that little bathroom where there's not really room to do that. And reading this book going, who the F are these people? Like, they are in my head. You know, I might as well have written this book. And so, that was the first time I was introduced to the word abstinence. And, you know, it's one of those things where you just kind of get what that probably is. And I sort of trolled online for about a week looking at meetings, and I eventually went to my first meeting, and then except for during relapse, there was about 3 months that I didn't come back. But other than that, I have been coming back, and that was about 3.5 years ago. But I can tell you, I did a lot of research in that 3 months of relapse, and it was enough to convince me this was the only solution I had ever found. So you like metaphors. So I have a metaphor that I've been thinking about the last couple of days about what being in my disease is like, because I'm just totally broken. I mean, I abuse my body to the place where I'm basically a corpse that is running on anxiety, fear, and adrenaline. So I'm like a zombie, because that's all I got. Like, other than that, I would not be animated without this anxiety, fear, and adrenaline. I'd just be on the couch like dead. So, basically, those years where I was the star zombie in my own horror movie. But anyway, so I did a great job. I was totally goth, believe it or not. I really was. I meant to bring my goth photos. I can't find them. I was really big back then, too. Anyway, so whatever. Because that is not the story. She's so cute. I cut my hair. So this is a funny story. I cut my hair really short because I wanted to be like Helena Bonham Carter and Fight Club, and everybody told me I looked like Stalker Channing. So anyway, I was like, that was not my vision. So I just wanted to read. So actually yesterday, so this book is very important to me. I still have the one that I found in the hotel room. It's actually moldy. I think I got the mold under the bed. It makes it more special to me. It's got all sorts of phone numbers and things in it. One of the things that it says in it, which I totally didn't get when I found the book, but I get now, it says, I can be right or I can be sane, but seldom both at the same time. And I read that. I was like, what is that person writing in this book? And now I kind of totally get that. But from yesterday's for today, it says, exuberance is beauty. And it talks about, you know, Western culture seems to squelch exuberance. As children, most of us are required to conform to a fairly rigid standard of good conduct in the classrooms and at home. And I was raised very religiously, so that rang true to me because the home I was raised in was crazy, but we were held to these very strong, very rigid terms of moral conduct we were supposed to follow. We mustn't be too expressive, too joyous. It is discomfiting to the grown-up person in charge. So I'm going to skip down. How does a full-grown human learn to express exuberance? Perhaps it is not possible to retrieve what was once lost, but this program of recovery comes close. The more I practice being as a child, especially when I take steps 3 and 11, the more my spirit is seized with an untamed joy demanding expression. For today, I am not afraid to enjoy what is beautiful, nor to express my exuberance in whatever way occurs to me. And I feel like that's what my life looks like these days. You know, I still have problems. I still get cranky. I mean, I got to show up every other week. I think I have to give up all my sponsees because I'm not perfect. And every other week, oh my God, I've got this thing. And then every other minute, I got this other thing, you know. But really, that, it's like that stuff happens, but it kind of like happens in this way that I see it. And I'm like, okay, so what do? I have a host of people that I text. I email my sponsor. Maybe I have some step work I'm working on that's going to help me with that. I go to meetings. I have sponsees. I work with a sponsor. I listen to those LAIG podcasts a lot because I really cannot underestimate, or I guess I can't recommend enough how powerful it is to listen to people talk for just that have like years and years and years of recovery. And on those podcasts, they have many people that have many different kinds of abstinence and ways of working the program. And I think it was listening to all those podcasts that taught me that if I did it imperfectly, but I did it anyway, it was going to be okay because nobody's recovery is going to look the same, you know? And I had a year in abstinence where I was unemployed. And that was a pretty rough year. I came to the Sunday night Ravenna meeting and moaned about being unemployed for that year, and or almost that whole year. But I got up. I called my sponsor at 5:45 every morning. I'd get up, I'd call her, and then I'd go back to sleep because that's what you can do when you're unemployed. And but you know, I worked the steps. I did a very, very thorough 4-step in that year, and then I gave it away. And after that, as I continue to work 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, I really feel as though I've been rocketed into a fourth dimension. And I am not the person that I was 2 years ago on the day I came to Serenity Night. And I don't know why, but that was the last day that I threw up. And some of the things that have also been going on in my program lately has been learning how to slow down and work on transitions. I do transitions very badly. And I think it's because I really related to Dave, who was talking about like getting into the car as fast as he could, because that's how I get into everything. You know, like I go from the couch to the bathroom as if like I'm gonna die. You know, it's like everything I do is some transition of like frenzy and whatever. So that really leads to some unmanageability. So, but you know, my higher power can help me with that. So this was not my idea. This was an assignment from my sponsor. And normally her assignments first, I'm like, what? And then I'll do it. And then I'm like, oh, okay, that was actually a really good idea. But that's also always happens whenever I think she's wrong. I'm like, shh. And then I'll argue with her and it'll be like some weird, uncomfortable conversation on the phone. And then about, it's like three, I have a 3-hour live with my own bullshit time frame. And then after about 3 hours, I'm like, oh, she was not wrong. And then, you know, she's, you know, it's really profound to learn how to take direction and to not be my own higher power. And really, actually, I've noticed that it actually doesn't matter as much whether she's right or wrong as it matters whether I'm willing to just do what she tells me to do. And so, which is good because I really get very attached to whether I think I'm right. I have an amends going on. So I can't remember what I was talking about. Wait. Okay, I'm not going to remember, so I'm going to talk about this other thing. So I'm jumping around again. I was going to write down everything that I was going to say, and then I knew that I would just ignore it. So I didn't do that. So sorry, you guys. but you wouldn't have benefited from it anyway. So one of the things that's happened is I made an amends the other day, because, and it had to do with gossip and speaking negatively about people on my team. And I apologized to my boss. And she was just like nodding at me. I'm like, why isn't she telling me that it's okay? Don't have to worry about it. I didn't say anything negative, because, well, the truth was I totally said things that were negative. And so, you know, I needed to make that amends. And, you know, and then I said, moving forward, this is how I'm going to work with the team. And I was like, why am I saying this? I do not want to stop being negative about these people. Like, they are not worthy of good, nice things. And, you know, like within 2 hours, one of them did something that was not worthy of good, nice things. And I thought about that amends, and I thought about what I was doing here, why I'm in program, and what this life means to me. And I just realized it doesn't matter if she was wrong. I really can't afford to make it all about this way that this coworker I have is. For my own sanity, I need to keep the amends that I made. And I think I just had this different experience. Like when I made an amends, I made a promise that I was going to do my best. I wasn't going to do it perfectly, but I was going to do my best. And I think that was my 20 minutes. So, no. Oh, what was that?
I think you've got 5 more.
Oh, I have 5 more minutes. What can I talk about now? So the new thing, that's the other thing that's coming up for me, is I am so into the doctor's opinion these days. Anybody who talks to me at all knows that. And the reason is that even as in abstinence, I have been so blessed with the lifting of the worst, most violent, darkest parts of my eating disorder. I am still a food addict, and I still periodically have to face food things. I want it to all go away. I want it to be magically lifted. I want to never have any desire for food ever again, and to approach every meal I have as if I was going to be eating little brown pellets of not goodness. And that's not how I am. Everything is delicious. Like, and if it's not delicious, then I don't want to eat it, and then I won't eat it. So I've just had to like really think about, you know, what the physical part of the allergy. I really want to focus on the spiritual aspect of the program, and actually that's totally fine. That's not something, you know, that's anything wrong, but I think that there's this additional element of the physical aspect of my disease and the phenomenon of craving. And one of the things that I've noticed is that through abstinence, I start to learn when foods perhaps don't work for me anymore through the phenomenon of craving. And, you know, I used to not crave certain things because I had the exciting stuff, right? But when I put anything in my body, the first thing my entire body is doing, is it fatty? Is it sweet? Is it salty? Is it this? I mean, it's like every food that comes in, it's a potential drug. That is how I had this experience. I drove up to Whole Foods the other day because I needed to eat before I saw my sponsor, because sometimes I don't do that, and then she has to feed me, and you know, Billy, that's not her job as a sponsor, right? So supposed to feed my soul. So I know she's gonna listen to this. Okay, so So I just had this moment as I was thinking about, you know, the salad bar where they still have the breakfast stuff out. What could I put together? What wasn't going to be too crazy? You know, making it balanced, la la la. What was the moderate size going to be? I mean, just whatever. And I was like, you know, honestly, there's nothing I can eat in there that will hit my body normally. There's just a whole bunch of things in there I can't eat at all. Otherwise, I won't stop. But it really, I just had this sense of like it didn't. I am not a normal eater, no matter what I do. And I think I can persist in the delusion that one day, as it says in More About Alcoholism, most of us have believed that if we remained sober or abstinent for a long stretch, we could thereafter eat or drink or eat normally. And I keep thinking that. I keep thinking like, well, if I could just, if I eliminate all these foods or I do this or I do that, then I will be normal. And I will not be a compulsive eater anymore. Maybe I'll still need program, but I won't feel like a compulsive overeater anymore. I don't know what it is, but I just realized as I was going in this like weird, how am I going to put together a healthy meal from a salad bar weirdness in my head? Like, there's nothing I can do. Everything that I eat, I need a spiritual solution in order to put it in my mouth. Like, it's just, however it is, I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows. And that has really been something that has helped me a lot. I never feel safe. It's okay, though. I have a solution, and it's here in this room. And I know people here who have that, who have found that they also need that solution. And I am not helpless. I am powerless, but I am not helpless, nor am I without hope. And I think that's the big deal to me. Because it's so easy to rest on that, it doesn't look like what it used to look like and stay there. But recovery moves forward. If I don't keep moving forward, I'll start to fall back. And if I fall all the way back, that's a really, really, really ugly place to be. And so you guys help keep me in a forward motion with this program, with working the steps. And I'm really grateful. So thanks, you guys.